A just published study is providing a look at Americans' views on religious freedom, and it finds overall a majority of Americans agree with the protections guaranteed by the First Amendment.
According to a new study released today as part of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty's first annual Religious Freedom Index, Americans strongly support the free expression of all faiths. According to the Beckett's Index, Americans prefer a hands-off government approach to worship and support a culture of accommodation for religious beliefs and practices.
Religious freedom is a simple concept, right? But how far are we willing to go to defend those whose beliefs may be very different to our own? This is Global Affairs Today. Let's start the conversation. Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Imani Cherry. It's often been said that if one person loses their liberty, everyone's liberty is in danger. Today we're talking about religious freedom, a basic human right that many of us simply take for granted. And we're asking this question: what happens when we work to protect our own religious freedom, but fail to speak up for those whose religious beliefs are different than ours? To start our conversation today, we're joined by Corey Porter, who is CEO of CSW USA, a human rights organization that works around the globe. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you, Imani, for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your organization. What do you guys do here?
Yeah, for sure. So we've started about 40 years ago in the UK, and we are a Christian human rights organization, and we fight specifically for those who've been persecuted for their belief or their right to not believe around the globe. So 40 years ago, our founder, Merv Thomas, started an organization, and over the last 40 years, God has been blessing us to be able to establish over 5 different offices in different countries, and we also advocate for more than 20 different countries around the world.
So CSW is clearly a Christian organization, and they don't apologize for that, but at the same time, you fight for the principle of religious freedom for people that don't believe like you, that aren't Christian. Or why do you do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think oftentimes people think that if you're a Christian, that you should only fight just for Christians. But we actually believe at CSW that it's our Christian belief that compels us to advocate for others. When I came on board with CSW as CEO, that was my first question. I was wondering, why would a Christian organization stand for the Muslim, for the Uyghur people in China and their persecution? And then we started to go through the scriptures, and Merv actually sat me down, and we started to look in Luke 10. And if I don't know if you remember the parable of the Good Samaritan. In that passage is the answer for why CSW chooses to fight for those of different faiths. So in that passage, if you remember, there's a man who's maligned and he's beaten before end of his life. And when he's beaten before end of his life in that passage, people walk by him. And who walks by him but the Levite and the priest? But the person who stops is not the person of his own faith, but it's the Good Samaritan. And the Good Samaritan just doesn't stop for him, but he binds up his wounds. He takes him into a space where he can be safe. He cares for him in the end. And he also pays for the debt that he would incur for being able to heal there. And so in that story, what ends up happening, Christ pulls back out and he says, who is the man's good neighbor? Who is a person deserving of inheriting eternal life in that passage? It was not necessarily the people that we would identify, the priest or the Levite. It was the person who showed, he said, Christ said, mercy. And so we believe at CSW that we're compelled to show mercy. Christ actually gives a command at the end of that passage too. And he says, go and do these things likewise. And so that's what CSW is trying to do. We're trying to go and be, as Christ has called us to be, people who show mercy to people who, regardless of their background, who need to be stood up for.
Corey, you said something powerful, go and do likewise. Corey, for you personally, what caused you to go and work on this issue of religious freedom? In your position currently as CEO, you know, you're new to this, you're learning what it means to be in this position. What called you to go?
That's a really great question. It's actually kind of personal. So years ago, when I was 18 years old, I was kind of more in the streets, if you will. And I was kicked out of high school. I didn't have a place to live. I became homeless. And then it was the Lord who was so gracious to me that he gave me the gospel through two campus ministers. And when he gave me the gospel, it totally changed my life. I began to be a Christian in college, but the freedom for me to be able to choose my belief that totally changed the trajectory of my life would be something that I want for everyone to be able to do, is to choose to be able to have an experience with the God of their choice. And in so doing so, what that allowed me to do was to go on and to be able to advocate for people on my campus, and particularly issues that matter to me, which is racial justice. So as a student activist from the age of 18, actually to 21, I led a national campaign to have a new mascot on the University of Mississippi's campus. All of that energy came from honestly understanding Christ and his richness of who he was. And so I believe that if other people, regardless of their cultural background, are able to have that freedom of choice, that they too can do good in the world.
So when some people hear the term religious freedom, they might become cynical. They might think of a certain group that kind of dominates that conversation. How do we bring more people into the conversation, into the circle, especially in now's, today's culture? How do we do that?
Yeah, I think you're right. And then, like you said, religious freedom is tied to a particular group of people, unfortunately, right now. And honestly, it's kind of left a bad taste in many people's mouth. But we know that human rights are not tied to one particular group, but it's actually tied to the fundamental truth of dignity and human dignity. And so I believe that we bring people in to advocate for religious freedom for all by just simply expressing what it does and the good that it is. And so I think a way to distance from the past and a way to distance from the ways in which people have used religious freedom for their own political gain or own gain in their communities is by simply just telling the truth of the goodness that religious freedom brings to our communities. When we think about our communities and we think about ways in which people are struggling, whether it be through housing, whether it be through food, or whether it be through food insecurity, or whether it be through other situations, what we'll notice is that if we pull away faith-based organizations, we won't be able to have much service in those communities. And so religious freedom is important for the po prison population when we have places that go in to minister to prisoners. It's important for the food banks when we have organizations that go in to feed the hungry. And so religious freedom is not just an issue specifically for the people in political power, but it's an everyday issue that affects everyday Americans.
That's powerful how religious freedom is about justice. It's about bringing people into the conversation. It's about being inclusive and fighting for all and for freedom. Corey, thank you so much. I truly appreciate the work you're doing at CSW, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Mai. Thanks for having me.
So we're taking a quick break, but we'll be right back with more of today's conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're asking the question, do we really understand religious freedom? I'm glad to welcome our guest to help explore this topic. We're talking today with Asma Uddin, who's an internationally renowned scholar, author, and constitutional lawyer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Imani. I'm glad to be here.
So you have a new book coming out. It's called The Politics of Vulnerability. Tell us, why did you write it?
Sure. So the full title is The Politics of Vulnerability: How to Heal Muslim-Christian Relations in a Post-Christian America. So I'm hoping to sort of entice some of your viewers with the second part of that title. And there's a number of reasons why I wrote it. One, I think there's a lot of conversation and analysis about America's rising political polarization. Quite frankly, not just America's, but political polarization in many other countries across the world. But very little of it focuses on the religious piece of it, the religious polarization. And so my book wanted to look at that on a number of different fronts, both the polarization between conservative Christians and liberals, and also interreligious divides between Christians and Muslims. And I wanted to explain how some of these divides, which are often overlapping, pose a very serious threat to religion and religious freedom in America. And beyond that, I also wanted to suggest what I think, based on my over a decade of experience in this space, what I think some of the solutions are to both help depolarize the conversation and also reduce these threats to religious freedom.
So your title says political vulnerability. Why did you choose that word specifically, vulnerability? What significance does that have to the conversation that you're trying to convey in your book?
Right. I mean, so the title, The Politics of Vulnerability, the focus on the vulnerability piece of it is just because vulnerability is so deeply human. We hear a lot of conversation right now about what a lot of conservative Christians, often it's framed as white Christians, are feeling in this country right now. We've heard terms like the evangelical persecution complex. We've heard the phrase that they're feeling under siege. We've heard the words like anxiety. And I chose vulnerability because I think, one, vulnerability really just kind of gets more at the question of just sort of very human fears and feelings. And the other part is because I think right now in our culture, the idea of vulnerability is something that a lot of people are very interested in. I mean, I throughout the book, I weave in insights from Brené Brown, who has essentially built an entire empire off of vulnerability, like, you know, trying to explain to people the things that make us vulnerable and how best to sort of lean into that vulnerability for the sake of just sort of self-development and just becoming stronger and creating stronger societies. And so both the cultural moment and the focus on vulnerability and also just the very human element of that. But then, of course, it's not just about vulnerability. It's also about the politics of vulnerability. And I think that's the part that I think is this problematic, the way in which instead of sort of being able to express that vulnerability, it often becomes politicized and becomes a tool with which to hurt other people. And that second piece of it is, I think, the piece that really needs to, that we need to contend with.
So you mentioned previously something called evangelical persecution complex. You know, some people might feel persecuted by what's going on. And they might react to it. Religion is such an emotive issue, a feeling that people have. So what does that mean to you? And how do we bridge the divide?
Well, one of the things that my book does, I mean, there's a number of overlapping, you know, studies and, you know, it's areas of empirical studies that I sort of work into the book, empirical studies and beyond. So I deal with social psychology, political science, and law and culture, right? So all of these things are kind of coming together to paint for the reader a picture of what's going on. So when it comes to religious freedom, for example, someone like me, who's a lawyer, specifically someone with expertise in religious freedom, talks about religious freedom in terms of the cases, right? Here are the cases, here are the laws, and this is how it all works out. But then so much of it has also become a cultural issue, right? Like in terms of, well, if somebody's bringing a claim in relation to, for example, contraception, abortion, or same-sex marriage, which are like the big hot topic, politicized topics right now in religious freedom, then so much of it becomes about culture and the cultural sort of response to that and the way that it's painted as, you know, a claim that reflects bigotry or discrimination or hatred. And so a lot of that cultural conversation then impacts the type of things that are happening in court. And then the third part is really just a way in the context of these sort of rapidly sort of changing demographics in the U.S., where we see both the rapid browning of America, as they say, where minorities or non-white minorities are going to soon become a majority, where you also see what author Robert Jones calls the end of white Christian America, where white Protestants have already become a minority in the U.S. So you see this vast, you know, quickly religiously diversifying country and the rise of what they call nuns, people with no affiliation. So all these different things sort of work, you know, together. And what political scientists and social psychologists have found is that religious freedom and like has become essentially what I would say is an in-group shield, right? So we are the white conservative Christians, and the best way to protect ourselves against these outside threats is to essentially sort of use the language of religious freedom to sort of advocate for our rights. And the piece of it that's really, you know, problematic, because I don't think that part is so problematic, but I think the part that's problematic is that when the in-group uses religious freedom to protect its own interest, what it also does, if you look at studies on intergroup bias, is use it to hurt the rights of people that they think are threatening. And so one of the groups that I look at in this case is Muslim Americans who, for various reasons, have been sort of lumped in with liberals, with all that is threatening to Christian America. And what you see is that religious freedom is being used specifically as a sword against them to deprive them of their rights because of this sort of intersection of demographic trends, political tribalism, polarization, and so on.
So we're going to continue this conversation right after we take this quick break. So don't go away. The conversation continues in just a moment. Welcome back to our discussion today, where we're asking, do we really understand religious freedom? Asma, I want to ask you a little more personal question. You've written this book. What drew you into this work in religious freedom in the first place? What in your experience caused you to say, you know what, I'm going to stand up for this cause?
Yeah, I mean, so I see what I do now as not really a job or a career, even as much as I see it as a calling. I can go back as early as like when I was in middle school, and I think actually even before that, I would say when I was in elementary school and first beginning to perform the five obligatory prayers that Muslims pray throughout the day. Just like the anxiety, the excitement and enthusiasm that I had for engaging in those types of rituals and prayer. And then in middle school, I think is where it became this very sort of intellectual endeavor. I sort of recall fondly myself as like the lone seventh grader walking around with a copy of Karen Armstrong's A History of God, trying to generate interfaith conversations among my fellow middle schoolers. And then in high school, it continued. And sort of as I went through my educational career, it became increasingly sort of refined and focused, so that religious studies was one of my majors in undergrad, and then in law school I focused on the intersection of religion and law. And so at that point early on in my career, when I was kind of forced to contend with, you know, what is it that I want to do with my law degree, it became pretty clear pretty quickly that it had to do something with religion. And that's how I found myself in DC working full-time for the defense of religious freedom. And since then, there's been a number of things that have kept me going. One, the abiding role of religion and spirituality in my relationship with God. Second, you know, just my place as a member of a religious minority group in this country that often deals with lots of stereotypes and discrimination, unfortunately, you know, high and ever-increasing levels of hate crimes. And then more recently, I would say, I mean, I think this is an ongoing trend, but I think it's become pronounced more recently, the way that political tribalism in this country sort of views Islam, right? We've been seeing a lot about what's going on in France with this sort of like, you know, conservative backlash against quote unquote Islamo-leftism, the way that Islam and Muslims are conflated with the political left. And I see plenty of signs of that in America as well. And so it's just sort of this continuing, very sort of like interesting, pertinent role of the way that religion plays into our national discourse and the way specifically my religion plays into it that has always just kept me very much like deeply embedded in the space.
So you've worked at the Beckett Fund, which defends the religious rights for different groups of people. I've understood that you've also defended rights, not just for your own community, but for all faiths, like Christian communities. Tell us more about some of the cases that you worked on.
Sure. So for a long time, I started off my career in religious freedom, working almost entirely in the international religious freedom space. And in that capacity, trained lawyers, for example, in Southeast Asia to challenge religious freedom restrictive laws in their country. And so we actually helped to bring a lawsuit against the Indonesian Blasphemy Act in Indonesia's highest court, which is the Indonesian Constitutional Court. And in addition to training the lawyers, we also filed an amicus brief in that case. I also trained lawyers in Middle East, specifically Egypt, and so Middle East, North Africa, so Egypt and Jordan, on how to raise these challenges and to understand international religious freedom principles in relation to what they were experiencing and seeing in their own countries. And I've also written extensively against the blasphemy laws in Pakistan, which is actually where my parents are from, because I think they provide just a very fascinating case study in religious freedom and in restrictions on religious expression. And beyond this, and after sort of focusing almost entirely in the international space, I then transitioned to the domestic space, where I've been able to work on just a wide array of cases. But it wasn't until 2014 with my work on the Hobby Lobby case that, of course, was a client of the Beckett Fund. And what I credit as essentially the sort of trigger for our modern iteration of the culture wars, that I really kind of, was just sort of like thrust into the space that religious freedom had become this big national question in a way that it wasn't sort of simply a question of religion, but very much a question of politics. And since then, have been involved in various cases related to the ministerial exception, which in one case that I worked on at the Supreme Court involved a Lutheran school. And then more recently, there were cases brought by two Catholic entities. And just beyond that, to religious garb cases and, religious sort of diet in prison, and so on and so forth. I mean, the types of claims are diverse, but it's all my focus in all cases has always been on the sort of religious claim, right? The fact that what these all share is that human quest for the divine, human quest to sort of live according to one's deeply held beliefs, and the sense of duty there is that religious believers of all types have in terms of implementing and practicing their beliefs.
That's great. Like, there's a shared experience, even though people might believe totally different things. There's this one shared experience that you're protecting here. So, you mentioned that there's a lot of, misunderstanding about what religious freedom is. There's a divide, there's conflating what it means with one group over another. How do we heal? How do we heal that divide? How do we bridge that gap?
Yeah, I think the first is really kind of going back to that very human element of religion. The part of it where it's about us as people who are created by God. We all have, there could be diverse sort of conceptions of that. But at the end of the day, that if we're religious ourselves, we can understand. And quite frankly, even if we're not religious ourselves, because I think all humans have an idea of the transcendent, however they might choose to define that. And so the extent to which we understand that about ourselves and about our need to live according to that truth about what this world is about and what the purpose of our lives is, then I think we have to be able to understand other people also as humans and how they're deeply moved by those same beliefs in terms of how they conceptualize them. I think the other part of it is to try to disentangle religion and politics. And maybe that sounds just very naive and too ambitious, but I think it's absolutely key. I think that, a huge part of seeing religious freedom and religion in terms of the human is to say that this is, again, a deeply sort of human experience. And it's not about politics or the politicization or the use of it by politicians, but also the use of it. I mean, religious communities themselves have to stop using it as a way to sort of just benefit themselves and to advance their own sort of political goals. And once we can begin to disentangle that, then I think we can move forward. And my book has some very concrete solutions and ideas for solutions sort of about that, sort of rooted again in studies that are empirical, lots of sort of empirical data, but also what conflict resolution experts have said in terms of what works when you're dealing with these sorts of divides.
So as individuals, how do we have conversations about this topic in our communities? How do we reframe how this topic is approached and how we discuss it?
Well, you know, one of the things that the conflict resolution experts talk about is that, and it's also sort of like backed up by all these different studies on intergroup bias, is that if a group feels like they're feeling a threat, right? We've talked a lot about evangelical persecution complex. We've talked about vulnerability. The more people feel that sense of threat, the more they sort of close in on themselves and are hostile towards the out-group, right? The people who are not part of their own group. And so one of the things that I propose in the book is that there has to be a very conscious reduction of that sense of anxiety. A lot of times now in the national discourse, we hear the phrase lower the temperature. And that's exactly a version of what I'm saying. I mean, you have to lower the temperature. And the way to lower the temperature is to genuinely listen to people as again, humans with very human concerns, instead of politicizing them, instead of moralizing the discourse, instead of saying that you, by virtue of holding a particular position, are evil and beyond the pale in terms of our conversation or our ability to converse. You know, if that's the approach you're going to take, all you're doing is heightening the sense of anxiety and threat, and that's not going to help anything. And so a starting point is absolutely to help people feel understood, even if you don't agree with them, and to lower the temperature. And that does wonders in terms of creating an openness and a willingness among people to listen to the other side.
You know, how optimistic are you that that's actually going to happen? You know, this world has been so divisive lately, and it's nice to talk about bridging divides, but it seems like people just don't even want to. Are you optimistic that we can do this?
I am optimistic, partly because I absolutely have to be. I think a lot of us are going to just, you know, be completely sort of like sucked into despair if we don't continue to strive for solutions. And I think, again, my religion absolutely provides me a guide there. There's a verse in the Quran that says that God created you into tribes, into different nations and tribes, literally using the term tribe. And we're talking about political tribalism here, so that you may know one another. And so this idea that, and all the scientists will tell you this too, that group identity is absolutely natural to us as humans, but it doesn't necessarily have to result in divisiveness, right? It doesn't have to result in hostility. And God tells us, you know, us Muslims in the Quran, that you're correct. The specific reason for diversity is so that we may come to know one another. And there is sort of definitive statement about the fact that we can know one another, that I have to believe that that's the case. And I think, you know, as divided as we are right now, I think increasingly people are also tired of divisiveness. Too often we talk about people at the sort of ends of the political spectrum and often overlook what one group has called, for example, the exhausted majority or the silent majority, all the people in the middle who are not easily divided among the sort of extreme ends and who are absolutely just exhausted and fed up, just done with the polarization and are looking for a path forward.
So this has been a wonderful discussion, and you at home, thanks for joining us as well. As always, we want to connect with you. Go to hopetv.org or talk to us on Twitter at GlobalToday7. Until next time, stay well, and I hope you'll keep the conversation going.